organizations or agencies have documented, but also by its Western backers, especially with Washington's intelligence. Will they be held accountable?
Sadly, not. The Western European empires have been going around the world committing war crimes, ethnic cleansing, mass murders, slavery, for 400 or 500 years now, and getting away with it. They have never, ever been held accountable for any of their crimes over the centuries. Today, the legal processes of the UN, and we have seen at The Hague, the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia, and we have also seen the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. These are bought and paid for by funding from Canada, the US, and EU countries. And what they are used for is never to prosecute the imperial countries such as the US or France or Canada, alongside the US, in their activities around the world, but rather to prosecute the people who are on the losing end of these wars, African leaders, Rwandan Hutu leaders, the former leader of the Yugoslavia, Mr. Slobodan Milosevic. So since they control these legal mechanisms, and since the U.S. has, and Israel, which, by the way, we haven't mentioned, is occupying with the UAE, the Yemeni island of Socotra, they have exempted themselves from these legal mechanisms, so they cannot be prosecuted anyway. So the shorter answer is they will not be held accountable.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. I'm afraid we have run out of time. Let me thank our guests for their contribution. Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War from Hamilton, Ontario, and also Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert, who joined us from Madison, Wisconsin. And that brings an end to another edition of The Spotlight.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Qasim and Shaykh Ali Himani. Shaykh Ali Himani, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome, brother. And Shaykh Qasim, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So today we want to talk about a very good and important topic. Should children use a smartphone without parental supervision? Especially during COVID-19 pandemic, we could see that the use of smartphones, especially for the children, in both primary schools, you know, and upper schools, is more than before. So, it is inevitable nowadays, in fact, not to use smartphones, but it had its own impacts on the lives of both parents and the children, the relation between parents and children, and so on. So, Sheikh Ali, let's start with you, brother. So, how to tackle this problem? How to deal with it?
Yeah, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Personally, if you ask me, that with the advent of AI, artificial intelligence, smartphone is no longer just a device to access information or yes. use it for educational purposes. So, if there was no AI, I would have said, yeah, there's no problem allowing children to use smartphones even without parental supervision to a certain extent, right? But with the advent of smartphones, there's advent of artificial intelligence, and yes. this has changed the game totally.
Okay.
Now, this artificial intelligence uses all sorts of inputs from your mobile device to detect who is using the device. And based on that device, it also pushbacks certain information, right?
Yes.
I remember my wife, she was sitting with her friends and they were thinking about, you know, the Sizda Rajab, the 13th of Rajab is coming up. So let's plan something in our madrasa. And they were talking about pizza, right?
Yes.
So they spoke about pizza, the different doughs and the different toppings and all that. And after 20 minutes, she was getting SMS from the Iranian services for pizza.
Oh.
So can you imagine how strongly they're using AI that she's getting SMSs from Iranian pizza sellers that, okay, this much discount for this pizza, yes. so on and so forth. So your microphone in the device is open
yes.
all the time. The camera, they can access anytime.
Yes.
And they're listening to it. So when they realize that a particular child is using the phone, then they know that it's the duration at which they can send in or push across certain
yes.
notifications, push across certain messages,
the pop-ups, windows,
pop-ups,
that's
and
right.
which can okay. take them to different places, right? From games to inappropriate websites, right?
Okay.
So in this current era, children under 15
mm-hmm.
using mobile phones without parental guidance is a high risk. And why do I say under 15? Because it's up to parents to do tarbiyat, the upbringing of the child, and bring him to that shu'ur of furqan, understanding
yes.
the right and
yes.
the wrong. And at that point, the child,
yes.
you know, can be allowed to access. But if he does not have
okay.
that furqan, understanding
yes.
the right and wrong, and understanding the appropriate from inappropriate content, then even at the age of 15 or even 20, the child is not
that's
at
right.
the right mental shu'ur
okay.
and mental common sense to be allowed a mobile phone without parental guidance.
Shaykh Qasim, what if the parents themselves need a guidance?
Yeah.
Because nowadays the parents themselves are busy with, you know, with their smartphones,
yeah,
you know.
Sure.
And the only way in order to escape maybe the questions and the queries and so many doubts of the child is to buy one for them, you know,
yeah.
and leaving them free in the house, do whatever you want and leave me free. I do, as a parent, for example, I do want to do my works, my staff, so do yourself, then there would be no supervision or something like that.
Yeah, actually the Islamic psychologists now say that we have to have this media literacy.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, we have this problem of illiteracy with respect to the
That's
media
right.
and the usage of media, how
okay.
to use the media. And actually, it applies to both, you know, adults and children. So that's a very actually the important issue. They have to gain this knowledge of how to use, you know, the media in the best way possible, and then they can actually convey this sort of usage to their children. So there are ways that we can sort of restrict our children to the appropriate usage of the media,
smartphones,
and especially the smartphones,
yes,
and social networks and things like that.
Yes.
Let me just mention a number of those techniques that the Islamic psychologists mentioned. For example, the first one is that you have to tell your child that this phone is not yours, because if once they feel the ownership of this phone, they feel that they can
do
anything, whatever they want. So
they
have to know that this is just a temporary usage, that they can have access to this phone, and this is not yours. This is what I tell my son.
Look at today's children and say, "Father, yours is mine too.
you are mine too."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mother.
Yeah.
Look,
so
all the devices in the house are mine.
Mine. Yeah. So
they put password on them, man. How to control them, the children?
Yeah. Okay. Unfortunately, this is what I say. You know, with all due respect.
Okay.
You know, this illiteracy that some of us may have, we started this way, and it may be a sort of hard for us to quit the way that it is. So the first thing is that they have to understand that it's not theirs, to use. So they have to take permission if they want to use it. Even they want to use it for, I don't know, for their school or for educational purposes or things like that. So this is the first thing. The second thing is that it has to be limited to in certain times.
Mm-hmm.
It should not be go on and on. Sometimes we see that a child maybe works with his or her smartphone, 6 hours, 8 hours.
Yes.
It's not this
non-stop, 24 hours.
Yeah. Some of the experts, they say it should not be more than 2 hours. Altogether, the media that a child uses, and otherwise it will have very bad impacts on that kid. So
it causes an addiction, they say.
Yeah. So
can I just add a point?
Okay.
More than just the addiction, there's a concept called alpha waves and beta waves in your brain, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when the brain is functioning, there is alpha waves and beta waves working in your brain. So when you subject your child to the screen time, be it your mobile phone or tablet or computer, even TV, even television, the rays that are emitted, the blue light that is emitted, the LED that is being used, and the constant changing of the frames, this causes the brain waves to alter from one state to the other state. And when it alters to the other state, it leads to stress levels, it leads to poor memory and
poor concentration.
Concentration and all those problems that Sheikh Qasim is mentioning, it comes from this alteration of the brain waves from alpha to beta and from beta to alpha.
Yeah, that's right. Sure. Especially with this world, nowadays they're talking about the metaverse.
Yeah.
With these goggles, big glasses that you put on, and you are entering a virtual world in which you can make your own character with whatever features you like.
Yeah.
It's getting worse. I mean, we are talking now about the smartphones. I think 10 years later, we have to talk about the metaverse goggles on your eyes.
Yeah.
How to face it,
Holographic stuff is...
Yeah, holographic stuff and all this. But the case is that, especially during pandemic, they were useful. I mean, the smartphones were useful, isn't it?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, because, for example, the children couldn't go to the school, so they have to stay home. So education was not stopped. But the case is that, are the benefits more than the damages?
That's the question that we need to ask. That
yes,
this solved certain problems. This solved certain concerns and issues that, we saved ourselves from getting infected, or children getting infected, or children being the carrier of the COVID-19.
Yes.
But on the other hand, we led them to another psychological infection, which is being addicted to the mobile phones.
Mm-hmm.
When the kids were given the tablets or the mobile phones to attend the classes online, every time they would get a break of 15, 20 minutes, they would want to fiddle around and see what's there in the phone, what's there on the laptop. And then it led them to addiction to different mobile games and different websites that they shouldn't be visiting and all that. So again, this is due to lack of supervision. And this is, I think, lack of supervision is kind of a natural thing that came in during pandemic because the parents were working online.
Yes.
So they were busy interacting with the client, solving the problem. And from moving to be physically present in the office environment to working online, a totally different way of working, they themselves were trying to sort things out for themselves.
Yes.
So they were busy with their own laptops and their phones, while the child found the absolute opportunity without any supervision to explore the phone he wants. And this led to dramatic results, which
right.
is negative. I wouldn't say positive, dramatic negative results. And
yes.
now a lot of parents are regretting that. Why did I let my son have this phone to this extent without supervision?
Yeah, actually,
they call it privacy in the West.
I believe that the preoccupation of the people is something, you know, so they are preoccupied, they are so busy with their own jobs, you know, and they don't have time maybe to supervise their children. This is one thing. The other thing is that when this child is looking at his father her father or mother, working with his staff, when you ask her or him that don't misuse that form or
Correct.
Don't use that a lot. So she or he would say that, you are doing, working with that smartphone
exactly.
all the time. Why shouldn't I do that?
It's like a father who's smoking, telling his son
not to smoke.
And like, Dad, you smoke all the time. What's wrong with why smoking?
Yeah, so I believe that maybe one of the steps that we can take, towards a sort of regularizing the way that our children are playing with the smartphone and actually working with the smartphone is that we ourselves have to start we have to sort of limit the times that we access our mobile phones and we use our mobile phones so that they can imitate and follow
especially
their father's
nowadays
parents.
When you're invited to a party or something, everybody is busy with the phone. Not looking at the face. Fortunately, I've seen this etiquette in some of the hosts, do not let any mobile phone inside the house, or there is a basket to put your mobile phone over there,
then.
Put it on silent mode or flight mode, not to use it during the party, and just talk to each other, chit-chat, and talking. But the content with which the children are now concerned is really dangerous.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be that for some countries there is a warning or a threat at the very beginning or rating for that, but they do not work at all.
Yeah. It's true that the parents are working with the phone all the time due to this pandemic. They're busy working and all that. And I had this problem with my 7-year-old daughter. She would see me on the phone all the time because I'm interacting with people across the globe. They're reaching me out for counseling and all that stuff. Sometimes I'm supporting some organizations from the intellectual point of view that make sure your work is within the boundaries of Islam and all that. So, and we used to tell her that don't use mobile phones. So she would come to me and say, Baba, you're using mobile phone. Why can't I use it? Immediately, I would show her the screen. Look, I'm working. Then I explain it to her that, look, this person is having ABCD problem and I'm trying to answer him. See? And I read the content for her. And then it's like she would, inspect me at random times. She would just come, she's playing, she would come running and say, Baba, why can't I use the phone? Then I'm like, look, I'm helping. I'm making a PowerPoint presentation because I have to go and record.
Okay.
I have to do a presentation here. I have a class, so I'm putting in my notes on philosophy and mantak. And she would say, then she realized that Baba uses the phone for educational purposes, for work purposes, for something that is productive and not for wasting time.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Qasim and
Sheikh
Ali Himani, for your presence in the program Viewpoints. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you to without you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. You are the light that guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Afghanistan has suffered crisis after crisis over the past decades, but the situation has perhaps never been so grave. Afghan people now have to live with the terrible mess left after so many years of war. There is no doubt that most of the problems facing the South Asian nation have their roots in war. The United States and its Western allies have been widely criticized for their 20-year military campaign, which wreaked havoc in the country but failed to achieve its stated goals. Afghanistan is now at a critical point. It has turned into a historic test for the international community. This week, top diplomats from Afghanistan's neighboring countries gathered in China for their third conference on the situation. They seem to understand better than other countries what is at stake if Afghanistan fails completely. The foreign ministers of neighboring countries called on the Taliban to adopt further measures to improve living conditions and guarantee the basic rights of all Afghans, including women and ethnic minorities. The foreign ministers also renewed their call on the Taliban to form an inclusive government.
Now, I think that there's potential significance in it if they can manage to produce the aid, and not only money aid, but if they can organize food shipments and fuel shipments and this sort of thing into Afghanistan and pressure for equitable distribution where it's necessary, then of course this conference could save Afghanistan.
Iran, which is hosting several million Afghan refugees, said during the conference that neighboring and friendly countries should strengthen cooperation in the reconstruction of Afghanistan and boost assistance to its people without political considerations. At the conference in China, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian proposed a security mechanism to coordinate counterterrorism policies by the neighbors. He also stressed that the root cause of problems in Afghanistan is the long-term occupation and misguided policies of the occupiers, mainly the United States. Afghanistan is grappling with an endless list of problems months after the chaotic withdrawal of the United States. The story of Afghanistan today is unending suffering for its people. Poverty and hunger have worsened nationwide. According to the World Food Program, 95% of Afghans do not have enough food to eat. Many millions of Afghan children face life-threatening levels of hunger. Meanwhile, outbreaks of deadly diseases among children are rife as the Afghan population cannot access adequate health care and routine vaccinations. On Thursday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres once again raised the alarm about the situation.
Without immediate action, we face a starvation and malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. People are already selling their children and their body parts in order to feed their families. Afghanistan's economy has effectively collapsed. There is very little cash. More than 80% of the population are in debt.
Afghanistan has been reliant on foreign financial aid for a very long time. But the need for financial resources has never been so serious. Afghanistan's massive humanitarian crisis has its roots in foreign restrictions on its banking sector. U.S. sanctions on the Taliban have left international banks wary of allowing aid groups to transfer funds into the country. Meanwhile, the U.S. decision to keep billions of dollars in frozen Afghan funds held in the U.S. is being blamed for a large part of the crisis. Calls have been growing on the United States to immediately release the sum it seized from Afghanistan's central bank, causing a devastating hunger crisis. All eyes are on the U.S. now to see if it realizes the need to change course and move in line with those who are truly concerned about the situation in Afghanistan.
The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge have concluded week-long tour of the Caribbean. The trip was to mark the Queen's Platinum Jubilee this year and saw William and Catherine also visit Jamaica and Bahamas. But the tour was marred by a series of gaffes and protests by local people over the visit. As the tour progressed, it became increasingly clear that a trip intended to show the royals as empathetic and in touch was sparking the totally opposite reaction.
The trip of the British royals to the Caribbean and Central America reflects the broader colonial relationship that the United Kingdom has had with the region. Countries like Jamaica, Trinidad, Belize, Barbados, so many others, Guyana in the region, that have been colonized and enslaved by British bankers, by a British royal family for centuries.
When William and Kate greeted cheering children by a football pitch who were standing behind a wire fence, the resulting imagery created a deeply uncomfortable look for the monarchy. And when they deliberately recreated the Queen and Prince Philip's journey on a Land Rover from decades ago, the wistful nod to a bygone era struck an odd tone in a country looking to move forward, not back. Earlier in the tour, William was forced to tackle Britain's historic role in the slave trade, expressing his sorrow that it ever happened. The move came following anti-colonial protests in Jamaica and Belize, but William fell short of a full apology. Jamaican President Andrew Holness said they will push for the island to be a republic with a referendum this year. Protesters outside the British High Commission in Jamaica handed over a letter signed by a group of 100 prominent individuals from Jamaica's Advocates Network calling for an apology and recognition of the need for atonement and reparations.
And so what the peoples of the Caribbean and also other places colonized by England are demanding is reparations. I think this is exactly what they mean by atonement, by paying for the sins of colonization and imperialism. We know that Barbados, Haiti, and so many other Caribbean countries, the sugar that was produced in those nations in the 1800s was worth millions today.
The United Kingdom has a dark colonial past in many different places of the world, including the Caribbean. The UK institutionalized the slave trade between the Caribbean, Africa, and London, stealing the wealth of its colonies to enrich itself. London, Bristol, and Liverpool, which were hubs of the slave trade, became wealthy and powerful. Britain formally abolished the slave trade in 1807, but only outlawed slavery in 1834, after the Slavery Abolition Act was passed by the Parliament the year before.
And actually, millions of dollars of wealth from the Caribbean in sugar, in tobacco, in alcohol was extracted during the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, up until the 1900s, when many of these nations won independence from the crown.
The British government paid the slave traders £20 million in compensation, 40% of its budget. That is some £17 billion. The government took out a loan to pay it, which was only paid off by British taxpayer money in 2015. That means the British government, using public money, paid slave owners, but not those who were enslaved. Britain's colonial past and its treatment of former colonies and the residents have raised harsh criticism.
And England and the Crown in particular are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth, in order to maximize their profits. And what the Crown represents is exactly this.
The Commonwealth Nations, which was created after the first half of the 20th century, after decolonization of the British Empire, is a dark reminiscent of British past. And now calls are growing to abolish the institution. Indigenous groups from Canada are visiting the Vatican this week for meetings with the leader of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis. They have held a meeting with the Pope discussing the Church's role in a system of boarding schools that abused Indigenous children for over 100 years as part of a government policy of forced assimilation. That was the Pope's first of four meetings with representatives of Native peoples, referred to as a process of healing and reconciliation. The discovery of more than 1,300 unmarked graves since last May at the schools attended by Indigenous children has opened old wounds. The residential schools were funded by the Canadian government and administered by churches. Canada's Indigenous people are now calling on the Pope to formally apologize as the head of the Catholic Church for its role in administering the facilities.
Untold numbers have now left us without ever having their truths heard and their pain acknowledged, without ever receiving the very basic humanity and healing they so rightfully deserved. That is nothing short of a travesty, both of justice and of conscience. And while the time for acknowledgement, apology, and atonement is long overdue, it is never too late to do the right thing.
The plea was made in a nearly one-hour meeting between the pontiff and representatives of two of Canada's three largest Indigenous communities, the Métis and Inuit Nations. More than 30 delegates visiting the Vatican say an apology from Francis in Canada would be an important step in the healing process. Survivors of Canada's residential schools have also called on Pope Francis to provide them with unlimited access to church records on the institutions where thousands of Indigenous children were sexually abused and mistreated over the years.
In my opinion, the apology by the Pope would have a limited value, in that it would show that the Church is recognizing its culpability and responsibility for the crimes that were committed against First Nations. The real issue of reconciliation would be the release of documentation and papers concerning the residential schools, which to date the Church has not done.
Over the years, the Pope has expressed his sorrow and sadness for the survivors of residential schools in Canada, but has stopped short of apologizing. Canada has been home to people for thousands of years and was first colonized by Europeans in the 16th century. Settlers took over and began to control Indigenous peoples. Colonizers imposed their own cultural values, religions, and laws, made policies that did not favor the Indigenous peoples. The nominal objective of residential schools was to educate Indigenous children, but the explicit objective was to create a system to isolate them from their own native culture and religion, to assimilate them into the white Canadian settlers' culture. The Catholic Church operated nearly three-quarters of Canada's residential schools, seizing more than 150,000 Indigenous children from their homes between 1830s and mid-1990s, spending months or years isolated from their families, language, and culture. Many of the Indigenous children taken from their homes by the church school system were subjected to abuse, rape, and malnutrition. An estimated 6,000 First Nation children died while attending the schools, and the search for more graves goes on. A Truth and Reconciliation Commission concluded in 2015 the failed government policy amounted to cultural genocide.
It would bring, as I said, recognition that they have culpability, and that's been lacking thus far. The church has denied any responsibility for things that happened. They claimed that it was a good thing and that it would help, but what it did was it was a form of genocide. It was cultural genocide, and the church has to claim responsibility for that.
Pope Francis has heard firsthand the horrors of crimes committed at church-run residential schools in Canada from Indigenous survivors. That's a positive step in acknowledging the church's role in this scandal. But will the Catholic Church and Pope Francis offer more than words?
Top diplomats from the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Egypt, and the United States hold a summit in the Negev Desert. Foreign ministers of the Arab countries hold talks with Israeli officials to discuss bilateral relations. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also took part in the Negev summit.
Israel is trying to achieve something that it basically has not achieved for most of its history. Namely, it is to gang up on the Palestinians and the Arab countries that support the Palestinians.
The controversial summit comes as Tel Aviv is pressing ahead with its expansionist policies, including settlement construction on occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemned the meeting. Hamas said the meeting is a symbol of cooperation with Israeli plots against Palestine and its people. Hamas reiterated its absolute rejection of all forms of normalization with the occupying regime, stressing that such meetings only serve the enemy in perpetuating its continuous aggression against our land, our people, and our holy sites. The resistance movement also called on the Arab countries that signed the Abraham Accords with Israel to reconsider their move to honor their historical responsibilities to protect Al-Quds. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad said on Sunday that the Negev summit reflects the loss of Arab identity of all those who agreed to be part of the enemy's normalization project. Meanwhile, the Deputy Secretary General of Bahrain's Al-Wafaq National Islamic Society also condemned the meeting, warning that the Bahraini regime was making a miscalculation. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in 2020 under U.S. brokered deals. Bahrain and Morocco followed suit, while Sudan also agreed to normalize ties with Israel. Also recently, the Saudi Crown Prince described Israel as a potential ally. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause. The normalization of ties with Israel, with a strong U.S. support, is widely considered as a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. However, despite opposition from Palestinians, the Arab countries seem to be obsessed with the economic benefits of establishing ties with Israel. They are getting close to the regime at the expense of the rights of the Palestinians. This seems to have further emboldened the regime in Tel Aviv to escalate its crimes. The regime is killing Palestinians on a daily basis. Israeli forces and settlers killed 319 Palestinians, including 71 minors, in 2021. That's the highest number since 2014. Also, 895 Palestinians were left homeless this year after 295 residential structures were demolished, the highest number since 2016. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. The UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned Israel's settlement activities. Israel also keeps hundreds of Palestinians in its prisons under the infamous administrative detention policy, which allows the regime to imprison Palestinians for years without charge or trial.
The options that are left for Palestinians are to continue unending resistance against Israel. This is really the only option. The more resistance they can do, the requirement here is to make the resistance so unlivable for the Israelis that the Israeli population will move away.
For more than four decades, the UN Security Council and General Assembly have stated in so many resolutions that construction of Israeli settlements in occupied territories are illegal and annexation of occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful. But Israel continues its activities with impunity, and that's mainly blamed on Washington's unabated support for Israel, whether financially, militarily, or even through brokering normalization ties with other states.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. This sharp jump in COVID-19 case numbers is being driven by the virus variant BA2, which is even more transmissible than the original Omicron version that swept Britain at the beginning of the year. We'll prepare for you an article written by Robin McKee. The piece is titled UK COVID cases at an all-time high. Free testing scrapped. So what will happen now? It was estimated recently that almost 5 million people in the United Kingdom are now believed to have COVID-19, an all-time high figure for the disease which first struck the nation 2 years ago. Scientists added hospital admissions and deaths are also rising, but not nearly so sharply. This sharp jump in case numbers is being driven by the virus variant BA2, which is even more transmissible than the original Omicron version that swept Britain at the beginning of the year. The latest wave comes just as the government has ended free testing for the virus and as the nation prepares to enjoy its Easter holidays. This prospect raises the fear that further increases in case numbers, followed by rises in hospital admissions and deaths, could afflict the United Kingdom. But as other researchers have pointed out, spring has arrived and warmer weather will allow more and more people to mix out of doors, where they are less likely to infect each other. In short, the outcome is unclear. So what is the likely trajectory of the disease for the rest of the year? And what key measures should be taken now to limit the spread of COVID-19? Should mask-wearing regulations remain strict? Professor Paul Hunter of the University of East Anglia says, "I don't think so, unless you're someone who is particularly vulnerable." The latest Office of National Statistics Characteristics Survey doesn't find much benefit of mask-wearing anymore, though that does not mean that face masks don't work. It is probably just that people who haven't been wearing face masks are more likely to have had the infection already, and so are less susceptible. This point was backed by Professor Roland Keogh of Edinburgh University. Professor Keogh said, "With all other restrictions pretty much removed, we have very little evidence that cloth masks, such as commonly worn, have much effectiveness against the Omicron variant due to its higher transmissibility." However, the vaccine expert Peter English argues that mask-wearing still has an important role to play in limiting the spread of COVID. Peter English says masks are particularly effective for source control, at preventing an infectious person from infecting others. And there are people who remain in high risk from COVID-19. They cannot protect themselves as well as they need to by wearing a face mask themselves. They rely on others to protect them by masking up in enclosed public spaces. Can Britons expect UK infections to peak soon? Professor Sheila Bird of Cambridge University says, "Yes, with respect to Omicron BA2, it will probably peak in the next couple of weeks in England and Wales, to be followed in 2 to 3 weeks in terms of consequent COVID-mentioned deaths." Professor Paul Hunter of University of East Anglia says, "In fact, infections may have peaked already. My best guess is that they peaked around 21st of March, but given that the Office of National Statistics Survey is a prevalence survey and always published a week behind, we should not expect to see falling Office of National Statistics estimates until next week at the earliest, and probably not until the following Friday, 8th of April. However, Professor Keogh added, "The picture is likely to be confusing." He said, "As testing goes down and surveillance is slowed or stopped, it will become very difficult to tell for sure." Are Britons likely to get a COVID-free summer? Virologist Julian Tang of Leicester University says, "No, COVID-19 will persist throughout summer and into autumn. It has not become fully seasonal yet, unlike the flu, which does disappear almost completely throughout spring and summer." He added, "The seasonal behaviour of flu also contrasts with those common colds that are caused by coronaviruses and which persist all year round, albeit at relatively low levels, but with peaks in autumn and winter." This point was backed by Professor Hunter. He said, "Even in the absence of a new variant, I suspect we will continue to see infections at a rate of a few tens of thousands a day, but most won't be diagnosed and recorded." He added, "We're only diagnosing about 1 in 7 to 1 in 8 new infections now, and this may drop. However, the rate of hospitalizations per infection is lower than at any time and does seem to be continuing to fall. So hopefully we won't see many COVID-19 hospitalizations during summer." Professor Kao also warned that infection numbers were also likely to remain high. He said, "We have to remember that for the bulk of people vaccinated last autumn, there will be a substantial drop in immune protection unless all adults are offered booster shots. This combination means that it is likely that there will remain considerable Omicron infections circulating, though we will expect the overall level to drop compared to now." What direction should vaccine development take to protect Britons against future rises in cases and new variants? A range of improvements in vaccines was highlighted by Peter English, who pinpointed several key areas when efforts should be directed. He told The Observer, "Current vaccines are very effective at preventing serious illness, but if we are to prevent transmission, we need vaccines which are more effective in preventing transmission. Ideally, we would also have vaccines which induce longer-lasting immunity. In addition, it will be helpful to develop new methods of vaccine administration, such as nasal sprays and vaccines that have been updated to match circulating variants, as well as COVID-19 vaccines which can be given in combination with flu vaccines." Peter English added, "We may well require an annual vaccination against COVID-19 due to waning immunity, just as we do for influenza. It would make a lot of sense to combine the two in a single annual jab."
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله إلا الله الله يا الله والله أكبر.
The Messenger of Allah saying were a manifestation of Islamic ethics, which he made known as the purpose of his mission. In this sense, man can be needless of many types of knowledge, yet he cannot be considered himself needless of ethics, since this knowledge is the capital asset of felicities in both worlds. The purpose and result of the summons of the seal of the prophets is the perfection of morality.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Ramadan. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini, talking to his nation, said that you have been invited to God's feast. The difference between God's feast and people's feast is that when you go to a feast, you will have some items of food to eat and means of entertainment. But in God's feast, one part is to observe the fast. Another important item, which is a spiritual meal for the unseen, is the Holy Quran. So in this part of his speech, he's talking about the feast of God, and he says that in the feast of God, which is the month of Ramadan, we are forbidden from eating at the daytime. In this feast, we do not eat anything. Rather, we fast. But the other part of this feast is the Holy Quran which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has revealed upon his prophet. And he said that we have sent down this Quran in the month of Ramadan, in the night of Qadr. And that is the importance of this month.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi.
Salli Allahu alayhi.
When we are going to the feast of God, we should think that how we should be. Because when we go to the people's feast, we eat, we enjoy the things, we do not care about others. But in God's feast, we fast, we care about others, those who do not have anything to eat. We become humble in this month. We need to have patience in this month. We have to bear this fasting and not eating and being hungry and thirsty during a specific hours of the day, so that we prove that we are the true servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is the time to prove that we are the servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And if we want to really benefit from the feast of God, then obviously we need to do our best in this month. And also, the spiritual meal from the unseen is the Holy Quran, as Imam Khomeini has said. Therefore, it is the month of Quran. It is the spring of Quran. And therefore, we need to pay attention towards the recitation of the Quran and towards the teachings of the Quran in this month. And if we are able to pay attention to these things, then we are really benefiting from this feast of God, which is the month of Ramadan, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
IRIB English Radio.